Donalana Kitchen talks about food. Donalana Kitchen talks recipes. Donalana Kitchen talks about lots of other things on community radio. Welcome to the Donalana Kitchen. My name is Lana Noctigal.
And I'm Donna Priskintas.
We get together here at KHOI Community Radio once a week, live, to come to you and talk about food, farming, advice, recipes, and opinions.
And we're very seasonal.
We are. We're going to season up your season a little bit here. We're going to be considering planning ahead for the holidays. What a novel.
The holiday. Oh, boy. Here we go.
What a novel thing. Actually, plan ahead. And there are things that one can do.
Yeah, and you've got many opportunities now to just show off and cook up things and have fun and be generous. And there's the solstice on the 21st, there's Christmas, and then there's New Year's. There's so many other excuses.
There's Kwanzaa, there's Hanukkah.
In between. That's right.
So
lots and lots of party time.
Which is all a wonderful opportunity to eat. Yes, to eat. We just
And make merry and share.
Yeah, we did. We just make merry and shared. I had a dandy Thanksgiving. What about you, Donna?
Well, first of all, I have to say the weather was outstanding.
Good job on the weather
there. All right there. Whoever arranged that, it was well worth the cost.
Yes, it was. Thanksgiving, a sunny, lovely Thanksgiving.
Unless the cost is... Anyway, we did enjoy it.
Pass the gravy.
Yes,
sir.
Yes.
I have a thumbs up and a thumbs down for my Thanksgiving experience. I'll give you my thumbs down first. I'm tasting different things. The idea, I ran across, this is actually a product, turkey and gravy flavored potato chips.
I tasted them. They were sampling them at Wheatsville.
Okay. Yeah. And?
They didn't taste bad, but they just tasted like potato chips.
Yeah. Can you maybe sense a little marketing opportunity?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Turkey and gravy flavored potato. But here is a thumbs up for Thanksgiving dinner. And actually, I didn't run across this for Thanksgiving dinner. I just had some, and it was used for all the leftover pie. And I sure appreciated it. Cardamom ice cream.
Oh, yeah. And that'll be good all holiday season. That's another item I found at Wheatsfield, and I put some in my freezer, too. It is really good. Or, should you want to make it, all you have to do is take any good vanilla ice cream recipe and freeze it up with a little cardamom added to it. It's no big deal, but it is good. And then, of course, there's eggnog, too.
With cardamom. Okay.
Yeah.
Ooh. See? We're doing
but
good.
But nutmeg is the tradition with eggnog.
That's true. This ice cream was good. It wasn't overly sweet. The brand name of this particular kind was Three Twins, an organic ice cream, and it said Petaluma, California, on the little container. But like Donna said, you can probably find other kinds, and you can make it yourself.
And the other thing you could do is take vanilla ice cream and just make a little cardamom honey syrup, which would be water, sugar, and or honey, and cardamom, a pinch of salt, and a little bit of pepper, probably.
Oh, and drizzle it on. Oh,
yeah. There's all kinds of ways.
Write that down, people.
Yep.
Write
homemade,
that down.
Homemade.
There we go. Mm-hmm. There we go. Oh, and so let's talk about planning ahead. See, all of these things, sometimes you can just kind of go to the convenience store on Christmas and kind of get some bath salt for your loved one. But that really is not as rewarding a gift, either for you or the recipient, as something you kind of plan ahead for. Let's think about things you can make or gather or craft.
And right now is the really, really good time to kind of knock out those things that you want to give to your neighbors, to the postman, to the ladies at the bank, all the people that really make our lives easier. And in this lovely small town that we have, we know all of these people. Even for closer family members, too. Like, I have kind of cousins all over the country, mm-hmm. and on an ambitious year, I make up boxes of fudge and mail about 10 of them out. Still got a lot of cousins. So today we're going to talk about the homemade gifts.
There you go. Plan ahead
the easy
for those
ones,
homemade gifts.
Basically.
Yeah, we're not going to kind of challenge you to things you don't don't do, because everyone does something good. Like fudge, I'm just not a fudgy sort of person. I do other things. Everybody's got their own.
I hate to tell you how easy it is, Lana.
I know. It's things from the heart. Well, what do you want to start with, Donna?
Well, I think we need to, first of all, it is now, finally, the absolute last week that if you're going to age it, you should be making your fruitcake.
There you go.
So, Lana was going to tell us there are light fruitcakes and dark fruitcakes, right?
Yes. Yes. I have a book called The Food Lover's Companion, and to kind of center our brains here, fruitcake, a traditional winter holiday cake made with an assortment of candied fruit, fruit rind, nuts, spices, and usually liqueur or brandy. Fruitcakes have a moderate amount of cake surrounding all the chunky ingredients. There are dark fruit cakes, generally made with molasses, brown sugar, and dark liqueur. Dark colored fruits, you can get your prunes and raisins and walnuts. And light fruit cakes, made with granulated sugar, corn syrup. Oh, I've got a recipe for making one with honey, too. And lighter apricots and golden raisins. Usually these things are put together and covered in a cheesecloth and soaked with liqueur or brandy, but there's lots of different ways.
Oh, it's so many different ways. Now, what is this spicy Siena fruitcake recipe? Have you actually made this one?
Oh, I've made this. I haven't made any other kind because I saw this recipe.
Oh, and Lana makes the, is it a dark one?
No, it's a light one.
Oh, we both make light ones, guys.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah, okay. This is from a book called Mediterranean, over 300 sun-drenched recipes from It's a German collection from Hermes House is the publisher out of New York.
Collection of Mediterranean recipes.
Edited by Jacqueline Clark and Joanna Farrell. That's a publishing house anyway. Copyright 1999. One of these big, beautiful, heavy coffee table books. Spicy fruitcake from Siena. It's also known as pianoforte, which is strong.
Yeah, so it's kind of thick and very chewy.
Very chewy, yes. Greased pan, chopped hazelnuts, whole almonds, candied fruit, coriander, cinnamon, cloves, nutmeg, flour.
Lots and lots of nuts.
Yes. You toast all the nuts and things. Now, the only trick to this one, and I like this book because it's got pictures. I can do the recipe if it's got pictures. You toast the nuts and mix everything together. You use honey and sugar to hold this whole thing together. And the trick is cook the mixture until it reaches 280 degrees on a candy thermometer. And this is the work fast. This is hot. This is fast. Pour that on top of all your other ingredients and stir it and quickly form it into a pan because it hardens up really quickly.
Oh, right. That's the pianoforte part.
There you go. And that's a spicy fruitcake
from Siena. Are we going to post that one? Because I don't know where else you would find that.
We could.
It's an unusual recipe.
I like this. Offer a glass of sparkling wine to go with this. It's a little slice of candy. Yes, it is.
Yum.
I will put the recipe up for spicy fruitcake from Siena. It has gone to potlucks before, and I have gotten positive reviews.
Well, mine is also a light fruitcake, but mine is really easy to find because it's in the joy of cooking. So I use the recipe called Fruitcake Cocagne, C-O-C-K-A-I-G-N-E. I don't know if I'm even pronouncing that right, but the trick that I do, of course, I can't ever just use a recipe the way it's written, is that I make my own candied fruit. Particularly oranges.
Ah.
Sometimes lemons. I have been even known to do grapefruits if I'm really wanting to torque it a little bit. But I would, and the candied orange peel recipe is also, there's a whole thing on candying citrus. And the good thing is if you make those candied orange peels, you can make chocolate covered orange peels. You can just eat them on their own. But for my fruitcake, this is I don't use any of that, the kind of candied fruits you buy at the store that come in neon colors and stuff like that.
This stuff that looks like it's irradiated. They really try to get the holiday spirit in there. You got your red and your green, but boy, is it red and is it ever green. Those are cherries? What is it that's candied?
I don't know. I never buy them.
Oh, okay. It's usually just called candied fruit, so yeah, I don't know what it is.
It's ubiquitous, but really, if you make it also, it's too sweet with not enough flavor for me.
Okay.
So I when you make your own candied orange peels, now there is one trick that they don't mention in the recipe, and that is, you know, you're using the peels, right? So before I boil them and boil them and boil them, like it says in the recipe, I actually juice them up. And then in the very end, when they're boiled down quite dry, you're getting it dry, then I put the fruit juice back in so that there's a little more orange flavor. And then you have to, of course, reduce it till they're very sticky.
Okay, because the idea is you peel or cut the rinds.
Just the rinds.
And the recipes usually call for boiling it in sugar water.
Right.
But adding more orange juice would be
At the very end. Plus, sometimes I do have some essential oils of, like I have an orange one, I have a lemon one, and sometimes I also drop a little bit of that in quite near the end. So you're really boosting that fruit flavor.
Candied orange peels just by itself is just...
Oh, yeah, and they can be stored. I've even got some... You know what the Buddha hands are sometimes? I've seen them at the Hy-Vee on the holiday.
Oh, it's one of those strange fruits that don't grow in Iowa. Really weird citrus,
and they look very interesting. They're called Buddha hands by some people because they look like they have little fingers, and they literally don't have any juice in them.
Ah. Is it a citrusy thing?
It is a citrus. It looks like a large, grotesque lemon that's grown fingers from it.
Oh, that sounds just real festive there.
But it is either close enough to what you call a citron fruit, and I have candied those. Mm-hmm. In fact, I think I have some in the freezer at home right now.
There you go.
Last a long time. They don't have as much flavor as the orange do. Oranges are, of course, really wonderful for candied. So if you're making a fruit cake and you start with the candied fruit, which is a good thing, you know, it's a fairly long process, but, you know, you don't have to, like, stand there and watch it the whole time.
Yeah, the idea is to evaporate or cook off the liquid.
Yeah, and you also, like... You boil the fruit skins for a while, and then you throw the water out, and you do it again. You throw the water out. You just keep going. It's all in the joy of cooking.
Oh, very good.
Yep, there you go. So a homemade fruit cake is none. It's not like this doorstopper stuff, you know, especially when you get your own nuts. And I tend to stick with, like, for this light fruit cake, I tend to stick with, like a lot of pecans, which are very light in flavor. Like, I don't put my black walnuts in my fruitcakes. I'm going a different direction with that. Mm-hmm. Save that for the divinity fudge. By the way, we're going down a little list today of homemade gifts that you can make.
That you can make ahead.
Yes. And also, in two weeks, we're going to do a whole cookie show. So this list does not include cookies, which, of course, are always wonderful.
Good.
Back to
fruitcake.
Oh, fruitcake. Oh, yeah, right. Then you have to, wrap it up, like Lana says, and then start pouring the liquor on every few days.
Wait a minute. Okay. Everything gets kind of pushed into the pan. And they're baked, right? Baked fruit?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, okay.
And I bake mine in a, what's the mold with a hole, the decorative mold with a hole in the center?
Bundt pan.
There you go. Thank you, Evan. Yes. I bake mine in a kind of a jolly little shape.
Ah, good.
Yeah. So that's the fruitcake business.
I like fruitcake. People have this, the old doorstopper jokes.
Yes, right.
Hey, they're pretty good. If you slice it open, and my heavens, just a little slice.
It reminds me of Christmas and my parents who always bought the doorstopper kind of fruitcake, like from the... Was it the Gethsemane monks sell them online at Christmas or something? They come from Kentucky and they always taste the same way. And my dad loved them.
It's probably penance for the monks and Christmas for us. So there we go.
They probably have a good time making them.
I think
it'd
be fun to make that kind of thing.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. So what else is on your list?
Well, at the top of the list are a lot of chocolate things, of course. Yeah. There's the old chocolate truffle, which is... Fun. I mean, the basic one is it's basically butter or cream and chocolate, and then it kind of hardens up. But if you – and then you roll it in chocolate. You can make a big batch of it, put it in the fridge, and then when you're ready to gift it, you just get a little out, you roll the balls, and you roll them in the powdered cocoa just before you present them.
Yeah.
So get those candy cups ready and have those at home, too, because you kind of want them nestled in that. Or fudge. Also, I use those candy cups for – which is small. It's the smallest paper cup.
That's what those little paper
yes.
things, candy cups.
And you can, if you go online, you can find them in red and green.
Oh, there you go.
Oh, I know. So truffles, but also the good thing with truffles is you can stick a little something in the middle, like a piece of candied ginger or a nut or a soaked raisin.
Or candied orange.
Yes, that's true. A little piece of orange peel, that would be good. So truffles are one thing that people love to give. And that's also very close to fudge. Now, I make a fruit nut fudge, which is really, really simple. You know, you just – I put a big metal mixing bowl on top of a pot of boiling water with the water not touching the bottom of the pan. And then, you know, it's basically – I use dark chocolate chips because I don't – I'm lowering my sweet tooth a little bit, you know. So I like the dark chocolate. So I do dark chocolate chips with cream. And then you put in – I sometimes put in cardamom. And I also, for the fruit part, I buy those dehydrated either cherries or raspberries. Cherries are the easiest because they don't have the little seeds in them. And I grind those up in the Cuisinart till it's like a powder.
Oh.
So you get no texture, but you get the fruit flavor from that. And then I put in – pecans. Now, I do sometimes put a little black walnuts in my fudge because chocolate and black walnuts are really, really nice. Another possibility is some cocoa nibs. And then some years I put cardamom. Sometimes I add coriander, all kinds of. You want it, at least I want it to taste like nothing you could possibly buy.
Aha.
So that's really easy to do. And it can sit, you know, for a couple of weeks in the fridge. And every time you need to make a little gift to take to somebody, you cut out a few squares and you make a little package. And that's an easy peasy one.
Good.
Here's a really simple one. Just get, you know, those little tiny jelly jars.
Yeah.
The smaller ones. Mm-hmm. And if you just, in the double boiler, melt chocolate and whole cream, whipping cream, and then you can season it a little. That's another place you can put cardamom if you want. Or instant coffee is always good with chocolate, too. And then you pour it while it's still hot in the jar, and you're actually making little jars of chocolate butter.
Oh.
Which are yummy. Just spread on breakfast toast or any. And those are really easy to make, and you can just have a bunch of them sitting in the fridge and haul those out for gifts, too. Tie a little red ribbon on them, you know.
See?
Easy, easy. Those are the chocolate ones. Oh, Lana has a good chocolate one. The infused vodkas. Now, that's another very – it's a good time to start it now because they have to sit.
Right. You have to start it now because it does have to sit. Actually, I should check the recipe because I think you should have started it long ago. But start it for next year.
It would still work.
It would still work. That recipe – is on...
It's on our website.
On the Donna Lana Kitchen website. Go to khoifm.org. Go to Donna Lana. Find our recipe page there. It is called Orange and Coffee Bean Liqueur. You take an orange and you stick a huge amount of coffee beans in it. And the recipe says...
You stick the coffee beans in
the orange.
So
it looks... the recipe says, and I'm not making this up, it says, so it looks like a medieval weapon.
Huh? Is that kind of like how they used to stick cloves in the orange and hang them as a pomodoro?
And this gets infused in vodka or brandy.
You drop the whole thing in the...
The whole thing.
Oh, cute.
And it just kind of sits there. It doesn't do anything for a long time, and you forget it. You put it away.
Well, speaking of forgetting it, I have to say, you know, I cleaned my pantry out this fall, and guess what I found?
What?
The gift that you'd given me, and I'm going now, what is this? And I unscrew it and I taste it. It was fabulous.
Yeah,
and it had
probably
been sitting there 9 months or something.
Right, right. That was the orange and coffee bean liqueur, right?
It was.
Now, see? No, that it's orange.
Oh.
But you were... But
it was yummy.
Because for a long time, it just sits there and there's this studded orange sitting in there. And then for some reason, it just gives up all at once. And the whole thing turns a dark, 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 dark coffee color. And see, what a nice present. Something that you find in... Next November, I think that's the best time. You think about your friends. Oh, what the heck is this? Oh, I remember that, you'd say. There you go.
That was really good.
Oh,
and
yeah.
There, you know, you can do a lot of quicker infusions to make little gifts. Let's see. A very cute one is that it take a couple of Earl Grey tea bags. And a three-day infusion is almost long enough for that.
Oh, yes. Oh, for in a liqueur?
Well, just in vodka.
In to make a
drink mixer.
Oh, that, I think I've had that. And,
yeah, we did that. We did it in the summertime. It's really good with lemonade. But you could do it with a lot of other things, too.
Oh, yeah. I do like Earl Grey tea. Yes, that does taste
And I think
good.
Maybe, I'm guessing here, but I bet a mint infusion would be good, too.
There you go.
For Christmas.
And put it in a little jelly jar and label it so
and
you know what it is.
And some of these could be, you can infuse vodka. You can also infuse brandies quite well, too.
Mm-hmm. So here we are. Now, see, this doesn't call for cooking, really. It calls for a little forethought. So
yeah.
So think of all these things that you can make and plan ahead. This is KHOI. This is Community Radio, and this is the Donalana Kitchen. We're Tasty Radio for the heart of Iowa. Welcome back. You're listening to the Donalana Kitchen, and we're talking about planning ahead for the holidays. Good stuff to eat. It's good to be prepared. Many tastier traditions take a little preparation and a bit of planning ahead. So what else you got for us,
Yeah,
Don?
So we're kind of doing things that can make little gifty items that can go on either a small plate or a little bottle or a little jar or something like that to, you know, to pass out to your friends and neighbors. So on this list, and this recipe we also have already posted on the Donalana Kitchen Show, honey butters. Now, this is a good one to make with children because basically you're just taking the butter at the room, at room temperature, and with the hand, with a little electric mixer on low, you just beat in the honey and the flavorings. And on there, I think we have one that's orange cardamom.
Mm-hmm.
Does it have coriander too? I can't remember.
Well, you ought to visit the recipe page every now and
then. I guess so. But, you know, the basic idea is honey and butter. How bad can that be? And then you add some, there's a cinnamon one. That's very traditional. And other flavors like that. And that's a nice one for, you know, like a six-year-old. Younger children can do this. You know, when you're trying to teach your children to think of other people and not just what do I want for Christmas, but oh, what can we make for Mrs. So-and-so next door, or what do you think Grandma would like for Christmas? And they can be very proud because they can make this. And if you have those little jelly jars, you just pack it in that, and you can get them to make their homemade little Christmas cards, and golly gosh,
perfect.
Isn't that cute, and won't everyone love it? So
yes, breakfast for the holidays, too. It's nice to have little cinnamon honey butter to
yeah,
put on.
Yeah, and that's a very easy. Another one that is not so much fun for children because it's not sweet, but it is very easy, is the infused vinegars. Now, Lana has, did you make some this summer while you had all your fresh herbs?
Yeah, not a lot, but some, yeah.
Yeah, so I would not use a hard white vinegar mm-hmm. or even an apple cider vinegar, but just even now, if you cut some garlic cloves up and drop maybe you've still got some, like my rosemary is still out there kicking in the garden.
Rosemary, sage, mint. Yeah. Actually, yeah, I have stuff that I just cut and hang in the kitchen, so I've got a lot of dried stuff. But, yeah, there you go.
You can also go, like, exotic, like a little curry powder. And you can do oils the same way. Vinegars or oils in little jars with, you know, nice stuff floating in it, some pink peppercorns. You know, make it look interesting and it will probably taste great. And put the little ribbon on it and there it goes. So those are some easy things. Some a little more complicated, which I did for Thanksgiving. But we do have this recipe on the Donalana Kitchen is my liver pate. Which is basically, I've used pork liver or beef liver and bacon. And it's a little more complicated, but it's actually easier than you think. And that poured into small jars with the, then you make the aspic on top of it. And that is a lovely gift.
Yes, I am one that always looks forward to a gift from Donna, from the liver pate. I do. Oh, and except this year, we were both lacking enough lovage. And
it's true. I was in the middle of making it, and all of a sudden I realized, oh, my goodness, both Lana and I grow lovage in our garden.
Yeah.
Which is,
it wasn't a good year for this stuff.
No, but still, it came up.
Yeah.
You know, there was plenty, and I forgot to dry it because you cannot buy lovage for love nor money, as they say, right? I don't know why. Nobody sells it anymore. It is a very celery-flavored, delightful, delightful herb. And so, of course, we grow our own, and I usually dry it, and I forgot to dry it this year.
Yeah.
And I went tearing through the pantry to see if I had any left from last year. No, I didn't. Huh? So I had to make it without it. And it was okay. It tasted good, but I missed the lovage.
There you go. See? One of those holiday traditions. Yes, it was. Yeah. But there's more stuff. There's anything else on your list?
Well, an easy one. These are with nuts. You can either make a spiced nut, which people do either roasting it in the oven, or I kind of pan fry mine, and I usually use walnuts. Let me think. So I put a little olive oil in the pan, and I put a lot of nuts in, and I'm stirring it up, and then I add salt, black pepper, marjoram, something else, coriander, I think, and some more heat, sometimes a little like Aleppo pepper. You know, you kind of adjust the heat according to who you're giving it to, and a little sugar, a little bit of sugar. And you can either do that in the oven or on the stovetop. And people do it, I think, with walnuts are quite good. pecans make a really good roasted nut. And people really, it's a nice little treat because it's not too sweet. And then one step further is making nut brittles.
Ah.
Which looks complicated, but it's not. It's basically, let me think if I can remember. It's like a corn syrup. You're melting butter and sugar. Right. Melting butter and sugar until they, in the thick cast iron skillet, until they turn syrupy. And then it's a matter of timing. Also, let me just say, the trick with nut brittles, is I have a Silpat, which is that silicone baking sheet, and that makes it really easy. I mean, usually they say, oh, oil a surface and this and that. But this is sticky stuff. It's also very hot. Mm-hmm. And I do it by color. You can use a candy thermometer, but I do it until it gets – it's not in the Joy of Cooking, I don't think.
Okay.
It's
probably on a website.
It's online somewhere. But the fun is to – vary the nuts that you put in. I mean, obviously you can do peanut brittle, which is the classic, but, you know, to make a nut brittle with, oh, pecans and hazelnuts, and do toast the nuts first.
Mm-hmm.
You can also put in cocoa nibs, any kind of dry thing. You don't want to put fruit in it, but any kinds of you could throw in a few ground coffee beans instead of cocoa nibs. But, mm-hmm. I mean, and spices,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, cinnamon, this, that, and the other. So if you pour it out onto the Silpat, it's really easy to deal with.
Great. I have a wonderful neighbor that gives me nut brittle, but she usually puts chocolate on the top. When do you put chocolate on the top?
Wow. Like chocolate chips or?
No, like a frosting. So it's a layer of brittle with...
Oh, so she's making it like... You would want it to set up and be hard.
And then start
to put it on. You know, then you end up with like a puddle-looking thing.
Right.
And you have to break it into the brittle bits.
Mm-hmm.
She probably frosts it after she bakes it, I would think.
I would think
breaks
so.
It after she breaks it.
It breaks it. Okay.
And the other thing I do... And this is really gilding the lily. I make my nut brittle and then I... make it into, I mean, really shards. In fact, I put some in the food processor, and I don't want it to be in a powder, but you want it really fairly fine, so you pulse it a couple times. And then when I've made the fudge, just as it's getting cool, but, you know, still impressionable, not completely solid, I press the ground toffee bits into the top of the fudge. Now that is a good dessert.
Now, see, these are all things that you give as a gift. And then your friends and relations will say, oh, I'm thinking of her again. I wonder if she's going to do that again this year. Because those things end up being really, really good.
Yep. The fudge is in big demand, especially the cardamom-flavored one.
Good.
So, And there's two more items that are easy to make. Syrups are very easy to make.
Mm-hmm.
So you can do, like, herbal syrups, mint, basil, which are good on ice creams. They're good in cocktails. They're good in, even like a little hot toddy kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I made a coriander syrup, which takes quite a lot of, I think we've talked about it, as a highball for an old fashioned.
Mm-hmm.
So we're going to do a special show on drinks towards the end of the year, and maybe I'll get that recipe out for you. But so flavored syrups are quite nice. And Lovage would be one of my favorite ones, but it's too late this year. And then the final thing that I have on my list for giving away, and this you have to make fairly close to the holiday, is a homemade eggnog.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. So you're really taking whole eggs and heavy cream and a little bit of milk and a little bit of sweetener and, you know, kind of whipping them either by hand or just a handheld mixer. And then you can put the nutmeg on at the end. And then depending on who you're giving them to, you either sock the brandy into it and then hand it out. Or you can just make a little... Here, add your own, whatever you want. But fresh eggnog, right? I mean, it doesn't taste like the store-bought stuff. It's really, really good, though.
What a good gift. So we've given you a good list of stuff here. And you can find out more, not all of these things, but a lot of them are on the Donna Lana Kitchen Show website. That's khoifm.org. Go to the Donna Lana place and find our recipe page. There you go. You are listening to KHOI Community Radio 89.1. This is Community Radio for the Heart of Iowa, and this is the Donna Lana Kitchen. We've been talking about planning ahead for the holidays. We've been talking about, orange peels and fruitcakes and things to put in jars and things to just not only have fun giving away, but have fun making them, too. You don't have to stress yourself about these. Just make what is good for you. If you make a good chocolate chip cookie, have at it, yes. If you make a good fudge, do that too. Let's broaden our focus a little bit and think about planning ahead on a planetary scale. Let's think about all the generations that will follow us. The following interview is from a past Donna Lana Kitchen Show. We have Carolyn Ratzenberger as a guest in our kitchen. We will consider something called the precautionary principle. Welcome, Carolyn.
Thank you. I want to introduce Carolyn. She is the director and founder of Science, Health, and the Environmental Network. Now, this is a national organization.
Let me just correct the name, the Science and Environmental Health Network.
Always reverse that. Pardon my dyslexia there.
We actually rehearse this and we try this so that I get to say what it is.
Okay. but I want you to know that even though it's a national organization, Carolyn actually lives here in Ames, making her one of our local heroes. Thank you for joining us, Carolyn.
Oh, my pleasure.
So Carolyn is a lawyer by training and an anthropologist before that. And she puts all of this into constructing the rights of future generations. She has lots of things to talk to us about, Carolyn.
Well, before I start on that, I want to thank both of you for your role in nurturing the activist community. Recently,
yeah, we cook a lot of soup for them.
Really? So one of the things that I've learned, especially from Donna, is how food is more than food. It is community bonding. It is nurturing. It is ceremonial. And that our work as activists is on behalf of those gifts, so that it's this call and response. It's this giving and receiving.
And I hope – I always find food is a very pragmatic, real element, you know.
It is. And so how better to express the gifts of the earth and then our gifts of service and activism back to the earth?
Nurturing community is an important thing. And in your work, you take in community as a huge, huge subject, and you also think of community not just here and now, but community in the future. So I've always been interested in this term, the precautionary principle. It sounds just good on its surface, but it has to do with the long term.
It's very sensible. Do tell us about it.
It does. And I'm going to start with the words themselves because I think we understand precaution. You know, that's a standalone word. Principle is one that we probably get on some level. But what does that actually mean? They actually came out of a German word. The German word is Vorsorgeprinzip. And what it literally translates into is the forecaring principle.
Forecaring. F-O-R-E.
Yes.
Or
F-O-R. F-O-R-E.
Uh-huh.
Forecaring. Caring for what might be a difficult future. And the work that we had done on the precautionary principle looks ahead. Now, at the time that I began the work on the precautionary principle, I was living in North Dakota on a very large farm. And I understood forecaring well. So living in North Dakota in the summertime, we were gathering wood for our wood stove. We were canning and freezing and gardening. We worked sun up.
It sounds like the ant and the grasshopper.
Oh, absolutely. And so I set out to prepare every summer and carry over enough in case I had a failed harvest for the next year. So that meant I had to think really carefully about a year and a half in advance because I didn't know what was coming. And so this work on the precautionary principle, this forecaring, preparing for what might be a difficult future, emerged out of a German concept of preventing harm in the face of scientific uncertainty. So what we were facing at the time that I began the work on the precautionary principle was that environmental policy was based on something called risk assessment, which was we analyzed the possible risk of some activity or a chemical, and then we decided what was an acceptable risk. And we couldn't interfere in market, whether it's a pesticide or whether it was a genetically modified organism, unless we had certainty about the harm that it would cause. As we thought, some risks, some cancers in children are acceptable, some disabilities are acceptable, and so we're going to tolerate them. And the Germans had built into their environmental policy this idea called the precautionary principle. It's a legal idea.
In Germany. Mm-hmm.
And in the United States after our work. It was written into the Rio Declaration. It's been written into two international treaties. It's the basis of San Francisco's environmental policy. It's all been reorganized. It's the basis of some laws in California governing environmental justice, many, many other situations. It's the basis of the treaty that binds together the European Union called the Maastricht Treaty. So this idea of forecaring, that doesn't tell you what to do, and it doesn't really tell you how scientific uncertainty is connected. So here's how it works. The precautionary principle has three elements. The first is the likelihood of harm. So what's the harm you're worried about? Are you worried about increases in cancer or neurodegenerative diseases like Alzheimer's or Parkinson's? Are you worried about more cancers? What's the harm that we're facing? And then there's scientific uncertainty. We don't know how big the harm is going to be. We don't fully understand cause and effect. There might be, lots of dimensions to scientific uncertainty.
You mean we don't know everything as a human species?
We don't. We're always learning new things. So, the best example is smoking. Up until the mid-1990s, mm-hmm. The tobacco executives could say with a straight face that that tobacco didn't cause cancer, lung cancer. Now, we had pretty good evidence that it not only caused lung cancer, it caused bladder cancer and lots of other things. But they could say that because the proof, the proof of causation is very difficult. So we couldn't prove causation with tobacco and lung cancer for one reason. We did not have the biological mechanism. We didn't know how it caused cancer.
Oh.
So for lots of other things.
Yeah, because There's a lot we don't understand about cancer, among other things.
Yeah. So let's just take learning disabilities. We know that the increase in learning disabilities and autism, developmental disabilities, have increased quite rapidly over the past 25 years. And we don't fully understand that. But we do know that, for instance, some pesticides interfere with the neurodevelopment of various species. Uh-huh. Well, and we know that they cross the placenta because mm-hmm. they're in cord blood. Okay. So what do we need to wait, or can we actually say, accept that there's enough evidence of harm when our children's brains are at risk? So the precautionary principle says scientific uncertainty shouldn't block precautionary action. Well, that's the third element, action. So you have the threat of harm, you have some scientific uncertainty, and then you have precautionary action. What's so unique about the precautionary principle is that it requires action. It doesn't require you sitting there dithering and saying, oh, whaley, 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 let's get more studies. It says you take action. It's a very forward-thinking idea. So what are those actions that we can take? And before I mention those actions, how we actually carry out the precautionary principle, I want to tell you the mysterious magic ingredient of the precautionary principle. So you heard that there's a whole body of science and philosophy in the middle of that idea, scientific uncertainty. There's a whole discipline in philosophy called epistemology that looks at how you know, who knows, how you deal with scientific uncertainty. A whole edifice of science is built on that, confidence levels, kinds of errors that you make. It's deep and heady and complicated, and I spent years of my life thinking about it and studying it.
It's a large industry.
It's a large industry. Scientists often don't study scientific uncertainty. But the magic ingredient is that there's another philosophical body of thought that underlies the precautionary principle, and that's ethics. So I met with someone from the National Institute of Health who, early on in the work that we've been doing on the precautionary principle, said, huh. He said, that's the first decision rule. The decision rule is the basic algorithm by which we make decisions. Do we accept a GMO and allow it into commerce? Do we approve a pipeline? What are the decisions that we have to make, and how do we make them? He says it's the first decision rule that he had ever heard that coupled epistemology with ethics. Well, that kind of surprised me. I'd been told my whole life we couldn't make decisions with our emotions. And I think they were conflating emotions with ethics, which is a bad mistake. Don't challenge a mother.
Excuse me.
Don't challenge a mother whose baby's at risk. You know, she doesn't look at the scientific uncertainty when the truck is barreling at her child who's in the middle of the road. She grabs the kid out of the street and saying, oh, we should have left it to the scientists to calculate the risk of the truck swerving is ridiculous. So the whole thing about the precautionary principle is what I started with, and that is that we're preparing for a difficult future. And it's the idea that the precautionary principle sets a compass for us and that the ethic is that our present generation takes responsibility for future generations and for their right to inherit a habitable planet.
That's an excellent explanation of what precautionary principle is. It talks to the ethics, the human in all of us. And we exist in time and space. We all have to deal with the future. That was an interview with Carolyn Ratzenberger about the precautionary principle, thinking about the future and planning ahead for our future. Our future
and
is a planet.
And caring well for the future.
And caring. If you would like to hear that whole interview, it was from a Donna Lana Kitchen on November 11th, 2016. And you can go to khoifm.org and find the archives for the Donna Lana Kitchen Show there. And you can listen to that whole interview because Carolyn did really fill up the whole show. She did. She knows a lot about that sort of thing. There's a lot of things to learn. That's it. That's it. We're talking about planning ahead. We had all kinds of things we can think about for the holidays. I would just want to mention that if you were planning ahead long back when you were harvesting things from the garden, you probably have some of your very favorite preserves that you made, or maybe you dried some basil, or maybe you make a really good pickle. Well, that kind of thing is much appreciated by people that don't have gardens or don't have other things, and those kind of things make good gifts, too. It's a little late to be making fresh things from the garden now, but again, I can say that on the Donna Lana Kitchen webpage, on our recipe section there, there's a recipe for hot pepper relish. And if you were ever so foresightful, as in foreplanning, that you put a lot of frozen peppers in your freezer.
And it was a good pepper year this year.
It was a good pepper year. You can, if you have frozen peppers in there that you just didn't want to use up right away, actually, that recipe works to make relish better with frozen peppers because you grind them up in your Cuisinart, and dealing with chunks of frozen peppers cooked down, simmered, it makes a much better texture than if you started with fresh pepper. It's tasty, but that turns to kind of a mush, which mush is good. But if you have
Or canned peppers. The frozen ones are the best.
It makes a really nice thing. It's got peppers and I use 6 cups total ground peppers, and that means five cups of sweet peppers and 1 cup of hot peppers. Something like that. Two trays, and a small lime. I put the skin and all, but do take the seeds out, grind it up, three cups sugar, and 1.5 cups dark apple cider vinegar. Cook that in a heavy bottom pan.
And it was really good.
That's a nice
thing.
And
didn't we eat it with cream cheese and hot pepper jam on crackers or something like that?
Yeah,
it was really good.
That's a good thing. So if you've got those, that's something you can make. Or if you've, like I said, if you did have things from your garden in your pantry, that's a good thing to give away too. There. So take some time to make something.
'Tis the season.
Think about Boxing Day, which is a traditional English thing of thinking about all those people that are maybe not related to you or all that close to you, but Boxing Day, the day after Christmas, is traditionally the time when I usually put a jar of jelly in my mailbox for my mailman.
Oh.
Yeah. He's a good mailman. Since I live on a rural route, there are some lumpy packages that he'll actually bring to my door down our long lane. That's a good thing. It's nice time to plan ahead for the holidays. And I want to remind you that a KHOI membership makes a great holiday gift.
Yes, for the person who has everything.
And even if they don't know what KHOI is, give them a membership. They'll be so surprised. They'll like that. I like that a lot. You've been listening to the Donna Lana Kitchen. This is Community Radio. Music today by Liz Carroll, Seamus Egan, and Martin Hayes. It was from a CD collection, a Celtic music collection called Joyful Noise. We're moving into the Joyful Noise time of the year. You can find out more about the Donna Lana Kitchen at khoifm.org. Support this fine community radio station. We are all in this together. My name is Lana Noctigal.
And I'm Donna Prisgintas.
We've had great engineering by Evan Taylor. Eat good food and enjoy life.
McDonald on a Kitchen Show is sponsored in part by Practical Farmers of Iowa, a member-based, farmer-led, nonprofit organization that has been strengthening farms and communities through farmer-led investigations and information sharing since 1985. You can find out more at their website, www.practicalfarmers.org.